Hello there, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. A little over 3 years ago now, in November 2018, I was joined by Bill Browder to discuss his campaign for sanctions against Vladimir Putin's Russia. Browder had been a successful businessman in Russia before he fell foul of the regime there and had been forced to leave the country. And when his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was murdered in police custody, Browder embarked on a crusade to persuade governments around the world, including the Irish government, to introduce the Magnitsky Act, which would freeze the assets of individuals associated with the crimes of Putin and his inner circle. Bill Browder, you're very welcome back to the podcast. I was listening back to our previous conversation, and among the very interesting things you said was, you said that Vladimir Putin was in some ways the greatest advocate for the Magnitsky Act because it was his actions which very often drove its success. And you also said that Putin's instinct when he was under pressure was to play the war card. Both those things seem particularly relevant today.
Yeah, he's not that hard a guy to read, and he's not that hard a guy to predict. So first of all, he's a person who never backs down, no matter how suicidal escalation would be for his own interests or the Russian national interest. And he's a guy who can never show any weakness. And unfortunately, when he embarks on a major invasion of a country, that becomes a very dangerous scenario, and I'm terrified about what's going to happen next to the Ukrainian people, and I'm terrified about what's going to happen next to the rest of the world, because I don't think that Ukraine is the end of his plans.
Do you think, though, that a lot of people have suggested over the last few days that he's miscalculated here, that he has gone over his skis, I suppose, and that while he is successfully assessed the weakness of the potential response from the West to many of his actions in the past, he may have got this one wrong.
He got it totally wrong. He was assuming that the Ukrainians wouldn't put up a fight, and he was also assuming that the West wouldn't band together and create real serious consequences for him. And both things have turned out to be not true. The Ukrainians are putting up a valiant, unbelievable, and so far, at least in the first few days, successful fight, and causing just untold damage and death to the Russian invaders. And the entire Western world has turned on Putin. 20 years worth of him dividing and conquering has all ended in 24 hours with an incredible reaction from everybody.
And that has changed so quickly. Less than a week ago, if you go back and look at the articles which were being published, say, on Tuesday of last week, there was a lot of criticism of the relatively mild sanctions which were being proposed across Europe and indeed in the United States. And then that turned on a dime, it seems to me. Is that how you see it?
Exactly how I see it. We started out on Tuesday with the sanctions, which I would give a 2 out of 10 grade for. By Thursday, we got to 8 out of 10. When they added all the big Russian companies and banks and a few oligarchs. On Friday, they added Putin and Lavrov. That gets us to a 9 out of 10. And now they're talking about doing the oligarchs and SWIFT. And I wouldn't give it a full 10 out of 10 because the SWIFT only applies to 70% of the banks, and the Russians will start using the other 30% right away. And the oligarchs haven't been done yet because they've just said that's the intention, but I have not seen a list of high-powered oligarchs that we want to see sanctioned. But we're moving almost perfectly in the right direction. And even with what's been done so far, it's had a devastating effect on Putin, on the oligarchs, and on the general society in Russia.
Are you surprised by the speed of that change? I ask because when last we talked, you talked about the challenges which you'd faced in trying to get the Magnitsky Act introduced in various countries and including in the EU as a whole, and you were facing a sort of a slow motion resistance, an attempt to just bog things down in bureaucratic paperwork to avoid actually taking any action, and also in certain places, I think it's fair to say, a suspicion that there was a deeper financial interests verging on corruption in some societies. People point a lot towards, for example, London as the laundromat for dirty Russian money. Given all that, are you surprised by how quickly things have changed in the last few days?
Yeah, my head is spinning. My head is spinning. First of all, I was surprised that Putin would invade Ukraine. I, you know, he's always had one foot in the civilized world and one foot in the criminal world, and always sort of had this balancing act, which allowed him to have all these apologists and people bogging me down in my efforts. And he, in 24 hours, by invading Ukraine, all the people, you know, by going to the criminal world, he lost all those people that he, all these sort of intermediate apologists and appeasers that he had. And I'm amazed that these countries like Germany, which was so desperately trying to appease him, you know, now supplying weapons and cutting off the Russian airspace and sanctioning oligarchs, and even Switzerland, like the most amoral country around, is freezing assets of Russians. It's remarkable.
But if you're surprised, why do you think it's happened? Is it just the sheer brazenness and the brutality of the invasion?
Exactly. It's, you know, Ukraine didn't pick a fight. Ukraine was just minding its own business, and Russia, unprovoked, goes into Ukraine with a false narrative, and then is perpetrating the most heinous, unforgivable, unbelievable violence against civilians, innocent people that didn't ask for any of this. It's just so unprovoked. It's such an unbelievable situation, and all these people who were, you know, trying to appease Putin for many years have realized that the appeasement didn't work. All of a sudden, he's at war, and the war is moving west. And, you know, once he's done with Ukraine, you know, he'll be, Poland will be the front line.
Is it our fault in the West that we let this get so far, that that a whole number of governments put up with all kinds of things that you know, at the time, you know, were extraordinary? The idea of people being murdered in these bizarre ways on their own territory, the egregious abuses of human rights, the various criminal enterprises, and the fact that many governments let that go more or less for many years is a really major contributory factor to why we are where we are now.
No question. So Russia invaded Georgia in 2008. We could have just put a stop to all this right then and there. We could have imposed all these sanctions then and there. And he would have then had to calculate, does he want to ruin his economy to do further stuff? And then he went into Crimea. And again, we didn't do anything. He shot down a passenger plane with 298 innocent civilians. Nothing. He perpetrated an assassination with Novichok in Salisbury, where they had to close the entire town down. Nothing. And so, of course, it's totally our fault. We've just empowered him to just do more and more. And he was of the impression that we would do nothing now. He miscalculated, but we gave him every piece of information for his miscalculation.
It strikes me, looking at what's happened over the last few days, that the Americans, I think, took the lead, I think it's fair to say, on some of these measures. And now it's looking, as we speak on Monday afternoon, as if the actions which it's taken against Russia's central bank's assets held overseas seem to be having a really serious impact on the ruble, and that may well be a really significant factor in the days to come. But as you say, the unusual thing that's happened is the Germans, first of all, they froze the Nord Stream 2 pipeline opening, and they have really pivoted, the Germans in particular, really quickly from their traditional position on these issues. And I was reading with interest an article which went up on a Russian government website by accident, apparently, a couple of days ago, which really set out the theory of the case from Putin's point of view: the re-establishment of a greater Russia, the righting of the wrongs of 1991, complete contempt for any idea that Ukraine has any sovereignty itself, and also an argument that France and Germany and the EU as a whole would be split off, or had split off, from what this article saw as the Anglo-Saxon view, and that therefore Russia could take advantage of that divide in its drive to build, I think, what was called a multipolar world, in which presumably the traditional Russian sphere of influence would be reasserted. So in a way, within all that complexity, it seems to me you can read within that the Biden administration over the last few weeks has played its cards as well as it could have, given the circumstances.
I think that I have a lot of criticism of the Biden administration, and a lot. But in this particular case, I think they play their cards perfectly. And the main card that they played, and this was so important, was instead of keeping the intelligence to themselves, they knew what was going to happen with this invasion. They shared it, and they kept on beating the drum and beating the drum and beating the drum. And by the time the Russians invaded, there was no other narrative other than it was an invasion. Now, if you go back to Georgia, there was like still people that say, well, you know, the Georgians started firing first, and in eastern Ukraine, all sorts of other arguments like that. There's no argument that could be made here. And so the entire world was faced with a terrible, tyrant and no other narrative other than he's a terrible tyrant. And so there was no way that anyone could not take the right position here. And that was beautifully handled by the Biden administration. And then they started leading on the sanctions. But interestingly, it wasn't the U.S. who wanted to sanction Putin and Lavrov. It was the EU that came out ahead. They were leading on that one, which I found to be remarkable and amazing. I've spent a decade going back and forth to Brussels, dealing with the most infuriating bureaucrats who, you know, used the most annoying politeness techniques to just shuffle me out of their office every time I wanted to talk about sanctioning Russia. And here they are, you know, pretty much, you know, on the same page as me now. It's remarkable.
When you look at the Vladimir Putin, who we've seen in recent days in his various, to my mind, really rather disturbing and extraordinary appearances on television, is that the same Vladimir Putin who you saw when you started your campaign more than 10 years ago?
Vladimir Putin is the same Vladimir Putin that I've always known. He's just facing a different set of circumstances. He's been a dictator for 22 years, and the Russian people haven't gotten better off under him. They've gotten worse off. He's looking across his border and seeing 18 months ago, the Belarusian dictator, the people tried to overthrow Lukashenko, and it was only because Putin sent his own troops in to protect him. Just a few months ago, the Kazakh dictator, Nazarbayev, was overthrown. And so Putin he sees the writing on the wall, and he says to himself, you know, they're going to come for me next. And so what do you do if you're a dictator of 22 years and you're worried about being overthrown by your people? You start a war. It's like straight out of the dictator's playbook. And so that's what this is all about. And I don't see a different Vladimir Putin. He uses different language. He looks a little more desperate, but this is the same guy who's always been around maximizing on his own self-interest, which is stealing money and staying in power. And I don't actually even pay attention to the words he says in these articles and these speeches. He's just a con man. He's a liar. He's an inveterate liar. And so one shouldn't even waste time reading the words that he says because they're all lies. He's like the Tinder swindler. Not an honest word comes out of his mouth. All you have to do is look at what he does and what his incentives are, and it all makes sense. He's a guy who has stolen an enormous amount of money. He's let the Russian people rot while he and all of his oligarch cronies are all in yachts and private jets and villas. And he's trying to keep the money that he's stolen. He wants to stay in power until the end of his natural life. And a war is the best way to do that. And so it's obvious to me what this is all about, which is just desperate actions of a man who's no longer welcomed by his people.
And yet, while accepting all that, again, when I look at those television moments, the address about a week ago to the Russian people, that strange event that he had in the hall in Moscow with his officials, it looked like somebody who was slightly unhinged, which was not something I would have thought about Putin before.
I'm not sure I'd call it unhinged. I would call it desperate, scared, and going for a big gamble. He's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't in his own mind. If he doesn't, he thinks he's going to get overthrown and thrown in jail and die. If he does, he may not win this war. There's all sorts of uncertainties, and he could end up getting overthrown, thrown in jail, and dying. So it's a scary time for him. You know, poor Vladimir Putin has kind of run out of road, and now he's trying to do crazy stuff to stay there. That's really where he's at.
The Magnitsky Act was predicated on an idea of putting intolerable pressure on the people, the elites around Putin by freezing their assets and making their life in the West, which they valued a lot, unpleasant or intolerable. Implicit in that is, would I be right in saying, the hope or the aspiration of some form of regime change initiated by those elites? I wonder how likely that is now.
I've never thought that the purpose of the Magnitsky Act was to cause regime change. My intention was always that if you go after the oligarchs, you go after the people with the money, you're kind of hitting them in a very targeted way where it counts, and effectively hitting Vladimir Putin where it counts. And the objective now, I don't think, is regime change. I don't think you're ever going to see a scenario where the people or the oligarchs rise up and overthrow Putin. It might happen, but I don't think that that's the likely outcome. And I don't think that that's a good reason for sanctions. I think the reason for sanctions is that Vladimir Putin is operating as a rational person where he gets a reward for doing what he's doing, and there's a risk to doing what he's doing. The reward, as I mentioned before, is that this cements his place in power. And the risk, on one hand, is the military risk, which we're all watching on television, you know, day in and day out, which is not going well for him. And then there's a financial risk. And it's our job, you know, it's the Ukrainian soldiers' job to create military risk. And it's our job in the West to create financial risk and financial cost to this man. And he has to do his calculations. When does it become not worth it? Now, unfortunately for us, once he's embarked on this thing, he's a guy who doesn't know how to back down. And so there's no easy way out. And we shouldn't even be thinking about offering him a way out. He's got to figure that out for himself. We shouldn't be trying to like give him an off ramp. You don't give off ramps to people who've invaded countries. He should find his own way out of this whole thing. But the best thing we can do right now is just make it as absolutely painfully costly as we possibly can make it for him. So there's no upside to doing this anymore.
But is it entirely about him? So, for example, if we do put pressure on, and I know you you pointed to the sanctions which were introduced by the United States in 2018 against oligarchs like Oleg Deripaska, who actually had some financial interests in Ireland as well, as the right way to put pressure on Russia. The implication of that is that pressure on the oligarchs ends up as pressure on Putin and affects Putin's behavior. Deripaska has been reported in Western newspapers in the last day or so as making unsupportive noises. I would say no more than that, but not entirely supportive noises about the invasion. Is there any sign of any kind of a split or a divide in the elites? And if so, how do you think that would play out?
So first of all, the reason you go after the elites is not because they're going to pressure Putin. You go after the elites because they hold Putin's money. So I'm not going to name names because all these people spend huge amounts of legal fees going after people like me for naming their names. But let's just say the oligarchs, most of them, are trustees for Vladimir Putin. And the reason you want to freeze their assets is you're effectively freezing Putin's assets. And so when you have these guys making tepid noises saying they're against the war or not for the war, it's not about having any view on the war or going up against Putin. The reason they're saying that is to try to protect their assets and Putin's assets.
I suppose the thing I wonder is, in terms of what you're saying about the psychology of Vladimir Putin, that he never backs down, he never takes a step back, and he's now trapped. That's a slightly terrifying kind of a picture to paint of somebody who controls one of the biggest nuclear arsenals in the world. And I mean, from what you're saying, if, for example, these talks, which seem to me to be largely performative, that are happening at the moment between Ukrainian and Russian officials, in the unlikely event that they led to some kind of withdrawal, that would so undermine Putin that things would be over for him anyway, wouldn't they? So I suppose my question is, what's our end game?
Well, I mean, you've pretty much put the nail on the head of the issue here, which is it is terrifying. There is no way for him to back down. I would just completely discard any peace talks as complete nonsense. There really is no way for him to back down. He just has to keep on expanding. And the only thing that we can do is just make it really difficult for him to expand. And so he doesn't have the money to do it, or he's run out of military hardware, or he's so embroiled in his current conflict he can't go further, because there's no reasoning with the guy. And as you said, if he were to like walk away, he would lose his power in a minute, because the purpose of doing this was to stay in power. And so it's a terrifying situation, and it's a horrible situation. And just because it's terrifying and horrible and it's hard to think about doesn't mean it's not true. And I think we should brace ourselves and prepare ourselves for really horrible things in the future, because that's who this guy is. And I pray for the Ukrainian people, and I mourn for them, because I know that what's going to happen next is going to be just heartbreaking.
So there is no way out, really, is there? I mean, if there's a stalemate in the current conflict, or God forbid it escalates and there's kind of a Grozny type situation happening with Ukrainian cities, or indeed if Russia, as is completely possible, manages to overrun Kiev and set up some kind of puppet government, that's clearly going to be entirely unstable. It shows all the signs of being a future Vietnam or Afghanistan for the Moscow government. And so we are now embarking on an era of real danger, aren't we?
We are. And when he's done with Ukraine, that's not where it ends. I mean, his big plan is to then challenge NATO, to say, go to the Ukrainian or go to the Estonian border, and then say to the Americans, are you ready to go to war with me for a country that most Americans couldn't locate on a map and have never heard of? And after seeing that we, the Americans, allowed the Afghanistan to fall to the Taliban for the sake of 3,000 troops, he's made a bet that he thinks he's probably right, that we wouldn't. And then he'd have the full former Soviet Union back in place again.
But so far, and it's very early days, and we're in the fog of war and all those kinds of things, it doesn't look as if it looked originally as if he expected, or the Russian military and Putin expected, that Ukraine would fall easily, perhaps lulled by their own propaganda about the nature of resistance to Russia in Ukraine. And we've all seen the nature of that resistance over the last few days. It doesn't seem likely that there'll be an easy toppling of the Kiev regime and then onwards and upwards to Tallinn and Riga and Vilnius, does it?
Well, I mean, that's what we have to hope for. We should understand that in addition to our moral sympathy for the Ukrainians, which I have a lot of, they are doing us an enormous service by keeping the Russian, by being the buffer, by fighting off the Russians so that we don't have to. And they're fighting well, and particularly well, given how outgunned and outmanned they are. And we should do everything in our power, militarily, with weapons, with financial support, with medical support, with everything, to give them the best shot at fighting these Russians off. And you're right, it's not going well for Putin. And it's interesting, because this is a terrifying outcome for him if all of a sudden he looks weak. He looks weak right now. If they can't actually succeed in Ukraine, he looks weak. And so even more than the military objectives of putting in a puppet government or whatever, he's got to overcome this perception that he's weak. All these burned out tanks and everything, it looks terrible for him. And it makes him, not that much of a force to be reckoned with. And he doesn't really have much else. What does he have? He has an economy the size of the state of New York. He has a military, which, by the way, the military budget of Russia is the same as the military budget of the UK. And by the way, and 80% of that gets stolen. So he's got this weak military of uninspired, unprofessional soldiers, outdated equipment. They're trying to fight a war based on war technology of 20 or 30 years ago. Javelin missiles ruin any chance of having a tank war. The 14,000 tanks that the Russians have are no longer useful, because thank God we supplied the Ukrainians with the Javelin missiles. They now have Stinger missiles. They can shoot all sorts of planes and helicopters out of the sky. And so all of a sudden, Putin's looking kind of weak, and that's terrifying, because he can't stand looking weak, and he can't afford to look weak. because everything that he's been doing now, everything he's done for the longest time is about this perception of his strength, which doesn't seem to be as high as the reality is not as high as the perception.
So I'm wondering, listening to all that, why you think that if things continue to go badly for him, why you don't think there is some possibility of him being toppled, whether it's the oligarchs or this kind of KGB state, which he built around him, of the sort of the officials, the security officials and those kind of people. And I know they all blur into each other, but that at the, you know, some of those presumably are to some extent rational actors. And at some point they might want to cut their losses with him.
Well, you're making one huge assumption, that things continue to go badly for him. I mean, he's actually, by Putin's standards, been relatively restrained. If you watched the actions in Syria, they were just indiscriminately bombing hospitals and children and women and refugees and all this kind of stuff. Or if you look at how they behaved in Chechnya, where they just leveled it flat, he has the capacity to do just unbelievable damage. And unfortunately, I think he'll be motivated to do that because he's got to look strong. And that's why my heart bleeds for Ukraine right now.
So that's a very grim outlook, which you've given us, because it seems to me it's either sort of a scorched earth policy in Ukraine, or am I right in saying, or indeed in addition to that, ultimately a confrontation, a direct confrontation between the NATO countries and Russia?
Yeah, sadly, that's the case. I mean, that's what we're faced with. Now, things may not work out the way he wants them to, and maybe he even goes crazier, and maybe NATO gets involved. I mean, there's all sorts of scenarios that can happen in Ukraine, and I can't predict all the outcomes. All I can say is I know Putin, and he can't stand looking weak. He never backs down. He's got a lot of arrows in his quiver in terms of nastier stuff to do, and that's entirely within character for him to do that.
A last question to you, Bill. The campaign that you've been running for the last decade or more, is that, have we moved to a new phase now? Is that campaign, or at least the sort of the detail of it, is that over? Have we moved now to a new phase of history in terms of the relationship between Russia and the rest of Europe?
Well, we haven't implemented my campaign yet. What we need to do is freeze the assets of Putin and all the people around him. Once that's done, then this is, you know, we've used that tool, and we have to see what else we can do to cause him trouble.
We'll leave it there. Bill Browder, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Thanks to Bill for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon. We'll be back with you very soon. Remember, you can contact us with your views at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But we'll be back very soon. And until then, thanks very much for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taking to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.